There's a simple principle for Dharma practice, for meditation practice, for Buddhist practice, that is very profound, even though it's simple. And I think it's very helpful for finding the path, being engaged in the practice. The principle is that the means, the way in which a person practices, should reflect the goal. And so what that means is that the goal of liberation, of freedom, of awakening, the various goals that Buddhism has established for, that Buddha established for the spiritual practice, that that somehow the practice has to be in harmony with the goal, or I like to say it has to reflect the goal. So that when you look at the means, you look at the way of practice, that you see in there a reflection or an image of the goal. So one of the primary ways in which the goal is talked about, especially in Theravada Buddhism, is one of attaining peace, getting to peace, finding peace. And so in the goal being peace, peacefulness, then the means needs to somehow reflect some peace also. There has to be some peace as part of the means to the goal. And that's been said by other people, you know, if you want to attain peace, be peaceful. The amplifier has a mind of its own today. So it goes up and down randomly. And so Bruce will try to catch it and follow it along. The means and the goal. One of the things this means is that in order to engage in practice, a person should ideally have some sense of the goal, some sense of what's possible. And maybe a better word than sense is some imagination, some imagining of the goal, or some experience of the goal, or some understanding of what the goal is. And some people certainly have a strong sense of what that is from experiences in their lives. At some point in their lives, they've had some experience of profound peace, profound well-being, profound sense of the truth, something that's very, very significant and then has been an orientation for the life. They know what's possible. And that memory of that experience, whether it's, you know, a conceptual memory or almost a felt sense memory, is there that's available. For some people, it's maybe encountering a great teacher, and that great teacher seems to manifest certain qualities that are very inspiring, and so that those qualities give you a sense of what the goal is like. Or perhaps it's from reading books, like for example, reading the Discourses of the Buddha, and getting a sense of who the Buddha was, what an awakened mind is. And you read descriptions of someone who's awakened, or someone who's at peace, someone who has great happiness, someone who is not in conflict with oneself or with the world around them, someone whose mind or heart is freed of greed, hate, and delusion. It's one of the great descriptions in the Theravada tradition of the goal. The goal is to have a heart which has no greed, no hate, and no delusion as part of it. Maybe it approves what I say, but it goes up, and it disapproves, it goes down. One of the descriptions of the goal is that it's selfless, that there's no self in the goal. And so the question is then is how does the means reflect the absence of self in the goal? Can we, in some way, the way we practice, can we look at how we self in our life, how we get attached to a sense of self, a self-identity, self-image, the way we want to represent ourselves, the way we want to protect ourselves, build ourselves up, the way we define ourselves. And there's something about that that we have to be very careful for when we're doing a Dharma practice and somehow find in the practice some beginning of becoming selfless, of not being caught in the trap of self. Because the goal is a radical letting go of self-attachment, self-clinging. And so how is that reflected in the means? How is it? So there's, you know, a lot of the negotiation of the path, finding a way to meditate, and especially going deep into meditation, you'll have to negotiate your sense of self-concept. It can be very innocent. It can be as simple as you're sitting here, and someone comes in late and very noisily and plops down right next to you. And how could that person be disturbing my meditation? This is my meditation time. It's a precious time. It's for me. All week is about other people. This is my time. And this person has interfered in my meditation. There's a lot of my there. And I would say that doesn't reflect very well the goal. And so perhaps another way of reflecting the goal is not to have all that I in it. There's an experience that's happening. A person comes in, it's noisy, it seems to agitate your mind a little bit. The person sits down next to you, and you hear the breathing, and just that's all it is. No reference to self in that experience. It's just a matter of fact. This is the way I was trained in Burma by Upandita, when we had to give reports about our meditation every day, most days to him. And all our reports had to be without reference to the self. You couldn't. You sat down and said, "Oh, my knees really hurt today, and I felt really, really sorry for myself, and I was wondering what I should do." And you know, he would just send you away for the day. Come back, try again tomorrow. And when you come in, you say, "Today when I sat down, there was there was pain in the knee." They better not say my knee, just pain in the knee. and that pain was experienced as a sharpness and tightness and pulling. I noticed that there was agitation. I noted the agitation. The agitation quieted a little bit. I noted there was fear. I noticed that there was some concern about whether this was healthy or not. And then the motivation arose to change my posture, change the posture. And I noted the intention to change the posture, and then the movement of the leg and so forth. And it was a wonderful training to kind of talk about things much more directly and immediately without the larger kind of concept of self. It can seem innocent enough to use self or me or mine, but often the idea of self, me, my, mine, myself, is a magnet for all kinds of associated ideas and clingings around what it means to be a self. I saw this big time when I was in Japan, the monasteries in Japan. I was learning Japanese when I was there. And I found out that in Japanese, you generally don't use pronouns, especially the first-person pronoun for yourself. It's just to understand who's, in context, what's going on. So, leaving. And, you know, who's leaving? But it's obvious who's leaving because the person just said goodbye to you. That person's leaving. So you don't have to say who, it's leaving. They tend not to use the pronoun. But when I was speaking Japanese, there is a way of saying, I in Japanese, watashi wa, as for me. And I would start every sentence, watashi wa. you didn't need to do it in Japanese, but you could do it. But because we do it in English, it was kind of hard for me to understand that you could say something without, as for me, I think, or whatever. And so it was a training in Japanese to step out of this constant self-referencing and always having to do with me, myself, and I. So the goal in Buddhism, there's something selfless about it. So can we negotiate or can explore selflessness in this moment here? The goal is one of peacefulness. Can we find out how to be peaceful here? And that applies to how we practice. I know it's really easy sometimes to practice non-peacefully. We sit down to be attentive to what's here, and then we notice what's going on, and then we are violent to what our experience is. For example, we might be self-critical. This is terrible. This shouldn't be happening. Here I am doing a spiritual practice, and I shouldn't be sitting here with lust. I'm a terrible person for doing this. I'm just awful. And that's a kind of violent approach. There's no peace in that. or there's a lot of self-reflection that can kind of be quite harsh and critical. And so there's no peace in that. So how is it to be present and experience something, whatever's arising in the present moment, and have a relationship of peacefulness to that, or beginning to do that, beginning to explore how to be at ease or peaceful, non-conflictive for what arises? And that's a huge part of the training. It's not easy to do, but that's part of the training. Part of the training is to start living the way the goal is meant to be. So I love that kind of parallel, that harmony. So the freedom from greed, hate, and delusion is part of the goal. So you don't want to then practice greedfully. You don't want to practice with hate. But you want to begin exercising your ability to live without greed, without hate, and without delusion, even in small steps. You know, where is the greed here? Where is the hate here? One of the ways which enlightened people are described in the early Buddhist tradition is not by some great attainment of, you know, oneness with the world or some great awakening or some kind of metaphysical kind of awakening, but rather is by the quality of who they are, the quality of being absence of greed, hate, delusion, being at peace, being contented. It's how we're changed, how we're transformed, which is really one of the primary things we're looking for in Dharma practice, not in having some great experience. The point of experiences in Dharma practice is their value in how we've been transformed by those experiences. There's a tendency among Westerners to be very experience-focused, having some great experience. The point of practice is to have some great experience. If I had that experience, then I'm validated. If I have the right experience, then I'm a good, right Dharma practitioner. And people will come to teach and say, I had this happen to me. Is this the experience? Is this the right thing? You know. But the point of experiences is not the experience itself. The point of the experiences in Buddhist practice is how we've been changed by it. Has it helped lessen our greed, lessen our hate, lessen our confusion, our delusion? Has it helped us become more peaceful? Has it helped lessen the kind of attachment, the clinging to self, which can cause so much suffering? Has it helped us become more compassionate? So one of my teachers, I asked him how you know when someone's enlightened, and he said, we have to watch them for a long time. And if they're helpful, then they might be. They help other people. So how we change is, you know, we're looking for some kind of change, but we don't wait for the change to happen by magic. You know, like if I know people who've done the magical approach to Buddhist practice, where they go to, I know some people who've gone on endless retreats and just sat in the cushion, and then got really bitter because he said, I went all these retreats, I did my time on the cushion, I sat there, and nothing happened. Well, what do you expect? You know, if you just sit, nothing's going to happen. You have to do something besides just sit there. If as Ajahn Sumedho said, if sitting there was going to do it, then chickens would be enlightened. There has to be some engagement in that process, not magical thinking. And part of the engagement is beginning to change ourselves and not waiting for the transformation to come from down from above. And so eventually there will be some kind of radical shift that is not of your doing. But in order to prepare yourself for that and move in that direction, there has to be a beginning of changing ourselves moment by moment. So, and very simply, one way to do that is how can I become a little more peaceful or more non-conflictive about what's happening right now, not uptight about it, lighter about what's happening right now. Enlightenment in English makes a wonderful pun, right? If the goal is enlightenment, the path to becoming enlightened is to be a little bit lighter. Lighten up, please. Sometimes people who practice get kind of grim and serious. And that doesn't reflect the goal. So lighten up if you want to get enlightened. One of the ways that the goal is described in the early Buddhist tradition is sometimes by saying it's stepping off the wheel. And most classically, it means stepping off the wheel of rebirth. The idea of being endlessly reborn, which is the ancient, you know, Buddhist kind of view of things, is considered to be not so desirable because it means coming back into a world of suffering over and over and over again. And so rather than coming back over and over and over again, stepping off the wheel is considered more appealing. Another way of understanding this is stepping off the wheel means stepping off the wheel of reactivity. So when something's happening, some experience is happening, whatever it might be, we find ourselves stuck in the orbit around that. An orbit is something where a planet, for example, that is in the gravitational pull of the sun, for example. If the sun let go of its gravity, stop doing gravity, then the Earth would stop going around, right? It would just kind of head on out, you know, out and out and out. But we're in orbit, we're caught. In a sense, the Earth is trapped, it's caught, it's by the gravitational force of the sun. When something happens, oftentimes we're somehow or other, because of our reactivity, we're caught by that experience and we're orbiting around it. So, you know, someone comes in here and is really noisy, and then you spend the next 30 minutes being angry and upset at the person and at me for having a meditation center that's in an urban center. And, you know, if this center was off in the woods someplace, no one would come late, it would just be me. And, you know, and the mind goes on and on and on about all this and that, and all kinds of schemes about how to make sure no one comes ever late ever again. We'll lock the door, I'll have a key, you know. So if that goes on for 10, 20 minutes, you are in the orbit. You know, you're stuck. And so to step off the wheel is to kind of step off the orbit so that we're not caught by the experience. Something happens. We're not kind of staying, you know, captivated by, caught by it. If you pay attention to your mind, you'll find that probably much of the time the mind is in the orbit of one thing or the other. And certainly if you sit down to meditate, that is why it's often difficult to stay present, because the mind is in a gravitational force of something or other. You sit down and the mind starts thinking about the future, thinking about the past, thinking of ruminating about something. And it just, you know, so easy to slip off, and you come back. And sometimes, if you really try hard to stay present, sometimes you start seeing the tremendous power and force of wanting to be distracted, wanting to think about certain things and be caught by certain things or certain feelings. And that's the gravitational force. So step off the wheel of that, step out of the orbit, is have a mind or have a heart or have a presence which is not caught by anything. That allows things to happen, to allows experience to happen, but doesn't then, not in reactive mode to what has arisen. Things arise. So in Zen practice, they sometimes talk about leaving everything alone and letting everything be itself. You let your friend be your friend, and let the friend person be him or herself. You let the wind be the wind. You let the cold be the cold. You let everything what it is. You let it just be what it is, as opposed to trying to maneuver and negotiate and react to what that experience is. So the goal is to step off the wheel, to step out of the orbit. And the way, if the means is going to reflect that, how do we start doing that now? How do we move in that direction right now? How is it that when you know, if you're sitting here and feeling uncomfortable, what would it mean to step out of the orbit, not be caught by that discomfort? How to let the discomfort stay, but not be caught by it? What is that? And so that might take a long time to kind of stay present and really explore that. How am I get to know it really well? Over and over and over again, Dharma practice focuses on the importance of understanding. You have to really understand well. Really understand well what is going on here. By understanding, then we can begin finding where the letting go can happen, where the freedom can happen, where we can step out of what's happening. So the means should ideally reflect the goal. So I want to read from the Metta Sutta. This is the discourse on loving kindness, but we call it the discourse on loving kindness. But the discourse talks about loving kindness, but what it talks about primarily is how to reach the goal. And here the goal is described of as a state of peace. So in order to reach the state of peace, awakening, liberation, enlightenment, one should be capable and upright, straightforward and easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported, living lightly and with few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters, and should not do the least thing that the wise would criticize. So then it goes on, in addition to all that, the person should reflect as follows. May all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be happy at heart. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, tiny or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere. Let no one through anger or aversion wish for others to suffer. As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so toward all beings should one cultivate a boundless heart. With loving kindness for the whole world should one cultivate a boundless heart, above, below, and all around, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, whenever one is awake, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the sublime abiding here and now. One who is virtuous, endowed with vision, not taken by views, and having overcome all greed for sensual pleasure, will not be reborn again. So in order to attain the goal, the means should reflect that. And the suggestion here is this is how it's reflected. It's reflected by being upright, virtuous, ethical, having some level of integrity, of being straightforward, not beating around the bush. A person should be easy to speak to. So it basically means that if someone's going to reprimand you, you know, or admonish you, especially from the monastic orders, what happens a lot, that you say, oh, okay, I understand, oh, okay, I'll do better, or I'm sorry, or as opposed to, I didn't do that. Being gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported, living lightly and with few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters, and should not do the least thing that the wise would criticize. The goal of Buddhism, the goal of liberation, can be seen as quite a lofty goal, quite an amazing goal. And to the degree to which a person is motivated to do that, it requires serious investment or serious endeavoring or applying oneself in one's life. And so it requires something of us. And this kind of description in the Metta Sutta is offering, suggesting some of the things that's required of us. We have to change ourselves just enough so that the Dharma can change us. Start living gently or peacefully with integrity. However, not everyone is motivated for liberation, for the ultimate goal of Buddhism. But even then, if you let the means reflect the goal, the practice becomes, I think, much more satisfying, much more peaceful. Because in a sense, if the means is reflected in the goal, then every step along the way is satisfying. Every step along the way has qualities of peacefulness, has qualities of gentleness, of love, of non-conflict, of selflessness, even just a little bit, each little step. It's been said that even if a person doesn't get enlightened, if the person's practice is sincere, it's almost as good. And so if your practice reflects the goal, it doesn't matter so much whether you reach the goal, because you can taste the benefit of what Dharma practice is all about here and now in this life that you're living. You don't have to wait. You don't have to wait. It's not a waiting game. If you're waiting, you're not reflecting the goal. So those are my thoughts. So as you continue your Dharma practice, all of you, you might keep in mind this little saying that the goal should be reflected in the means. And that as you kind of negotiate and find your way, that little statement maybe will help you find how to do the Dharma practice in a more satisfying and productive way. So we have some time for questions about this talk or anything else. I'm not going to be here for a few weeks, so if you have any questions you'd like to ask, this might be a good time. Yes, if you don't mind using the mic so that everyone can hear.
Talking about being in an orbit, in the last week or so, I'm in a family orbit that I'm afraid that my actions will create harm, and not to get into details, but you know, my meditations have been recently on not to do harm in the situation and to have compassion.
So you're in a family situation, you're in orbit around it, and you're wondering how to be involved in this difficult family situation without causing more harm. Is that right? It's very open-ended. I mean, it's very hard to kind of give advice. But what you might do is get my book here and read the Metta Sutta 3 times before you have to talk to anybody. Just read it through, or even better, memorize it, and then recite it to yourself. Sometimes the teachings of that little discourse, if you just recite it, kind of, it's a concentration practice. It can help you become calm. It can inspire you for a different possibility, another way. And then when you enter into the situation, you have to say something. Maybe you're more likely to speak in a kind way or non-reactive way. That's one thing you might do. The other thing to do is, and it doesn't always work, but I'm very fond of being straightforward, best I can. So before there's a crisis, so I'm coming over to see you guys soon. You know, I know we have this family difficulty, and I'm really reflecting a lot about how not to get reactive. And so you should know that I'm struggling with that. And do you have any advice for me? Do you have to put it all on the table? And so that, and not wait until the crisis arises. And I know some couples where the anger has been a problem in their relationship, sometime when they're not angry, will sit down and say, let's kind of talk about this tendency for us to get explosive. And let's make some plan. Maybe whenever that starts to happening, maybe any one of us could kind of raise our hand. That means 5-minute silence. And then we'll talk about it, but let's always take the silence. 5 minutes. So you make a plan ahead of time. So, I mean, I don't know your details, so I have no idea whether this... You want to ask more, or just relevant to what I said?
You know, as parents get older, and you have to be the caregiver or make decisions for that person, and they're not quite totally incapacitated to take care of themselves, it seems like someone should be forthright in to keep that person out of danger, but right. Yet not to take over. You know,
right. I think that T.S. Eliot said in his 4 Quartets, he said, teach me to care and not to care. And I think that captures very well the notion of Buddhist practice, where it's important to care and to offer compassionate care and all that. But also, it needs to be balanced with not caring. So it's not cold-hearted, but care and not to care. And one of the ways to do that is not to have anything at stake. And so you try to do what's the responsible, careful, compassionate thing to do, but you don't have anything to stake. Your ego is not invested in it. And if someone gets angry at you for your good intentions, you're not in the orbit. You know, it's okay. Well, my mother got angry with me, but you know, that's unfortunate. But you're free. You know, you're free of statements. You know, being liked and not liked. You don't have anything at stake. So one of the things to do in mindfulness practice is to look at what is it we have at stake in this situation, and question that, and then can we become free so we have nothing at stake? It doesn't mean that we don't actively get involved, but it means that we're not going to be caught.
In terms of envisioning, how detailed would you say one needs to be?
Envisioning the goal? Yeah. Having an image of it, imagination? I don't know, I never thought about it that way, how detailed. I don't know how to answer that question, except that I think an important element of Buddhist practice is using our imagination. I mean, it's an important part of any human life. And sometimes in mindfulness circles, we keep talking about being here and now and letting go of our imagination. Sometimes people don't understand that imagination is actually a very important part of life. And it has a time and place for it. And you know, if you go to a restaurant and then you need to go to the bathroom, most of us imagine where it might be in the back of the restaurant. Sometimes our imagination is wrong, but we have to use our imagination to find it, in order to find the goal. So to have some imagination of what's possible, spiritually, I think, is a very important. A certain phase of spiritual life is very important. And how do you get a really good sense of that? I mean, classically, there's instructions to reflect on it, to reflect on the qualities of the Buddha. So there's all these lists of qualities that the Buddha has. But some of those qualities are, you know, kind of superhuman. They don't really relate. It's hard to relate to them for ourselves. For me, it was a lot of and different things. One was my experiences I was having in life, in my meditation or my earlier life. Certain were kind of touchstones for me that showed me what was possible. And then as I used those as touchstones, as guides for finding my way. Also, I was very inspired by different teachers I met or different practitioners I met. It was very important for me to meet people and have them as models for me what was possible. So, what's possible. There seems to be very little self in that person. And how can that be? And I have so much self. And is it really safe to let go of it? I felt, you know, maybe it's not safe. I need it in order to feel, you know, responsible or safe in this world. But that person seems to be quite safe and take care of herself just fine. And, you know, and so I, you know, that helped, that part of my negotiation, part of my exploration was seeing it in someone else. So one of the things that is often recommended is that when you have opportunity to go see great teachers, is to go take that opportunity to go check them out, be around them. When I went to Nepal, it was a whole story, but on the way to Asia, this guy at the airport in Seoul said, "Oh, if you ever go to Nepal, check out this monk. He speaks English." And I wasn't planning to go, but I ended up going anyway to Nepal. And so I had this little address of this monk who speaks English. And so I said, I went and found where the place was and this town. And then we got to town. I showed people this name. Oh, he's over there and over there. Came to this monastery, he's there, and showed people that, you know, people didn't speak English, so I just showed it the name. Oh, he's up there. So I walk up the steps, up next floor, got to the top floor. And this monk speaks English, right? Monks are simple, humble guys. And so there was this this monk in a little, you know, room, a little monk cell, like it's supposed to be really small, just a bed and a table. And so I knocked on the door, and he invited me, and I walked in, and with my shoes on, and he sat down in the chair, and we started having a talk for a while, and then all these Westerners starting showing up, And they would get down on their knees outside the door and crawl in to see him. Instead, he'd sit there below and he was in his bed, you know. And I thought, oh, this guy's maybe more important than I realize. And then, so I was asking him different questions about the nature of consciousness and stuff. And he said, oh, you have to go see a real master. You have to, and so and he pointed out his window and go over there and see his holiness. And so, I didn't know anything about his holiness. I knew the Dalai Lama was called the holiness, but I didn't think he was in town, so go see his holiness. So I looked out the window, and there was a little building down there further. So I went and found where it was, and his holiness was giving teachings. And so I said, come back later. So I came back later. And it was one of the great Tibetan teachers named Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And he was already quite old, big man. And finally I was ushered in to see him, and the way he was teaching was kind of strange. It was kind of like there was a room, and then there was like a, you know, I would normally think like a closet, walk-in closet, on the other end of the room with a curtain. And the curtain was pulled a little bit, and he was sitting there in the closet teaching. And so I was ushered in, and I offered him the white scarf that you do for Tibetan teachers, and they offered it back. And I had this really strong hit that I was in the presence of someone really wonderful. And so I wanted to just, somehow I felt really important, just take that in. And the translator said, you have a question for him? And I said, no. You know, I just wanted to hang out there. And then I was ushered out. I didn't have the wherewithal to ask a question, you know, in order to linger and stay. And so, that was, you know, kind of a lost opportunity. I never went back. So anyway, that was, yes, in the back.
Can you speak to that?
Were you able to hear it? Accepting things and instituting change.
Right, in society or in organizations. How to manage people, etc.
How to manage people.
Yeah, it seems controlling. And then if I'm sitting in a lotus position and accepting everything, how do I stimulate change?
Yeah,
so I'm struggling with that.
Big time. Is it your job to direct people?
Well, I come in as a consultant and... I'm in quotes a change manager.
The word acceptance is used a lot. There's a book now called Radical Acceptance. It's a lot about the mind accepting things as they are. But I think what that means is not. I think it has. It's best to think of it having a very, very particular meaning. It means that you're going to accept it into awareness. Without awareness getting contracted, or resistant, or hard, or brittle. So somehow you're allowed into your heart, and the heart is quite stays spacious and open and present. The heart doesn't react. It doesn't mean that you accept this as a good thing, or that it doesn't mean that you don't try to change something, but the event that you're in, your heart stays at peace in the situation. So your heart doesn't, your awareness doesn't react. It's accepted into awareness. The awareness is inclusive, is accepting, is receptive. It allows it to be there. So it's one of the trainings of sitting on a cushion is learning how to be present without having to do anything about what's here. It's a very powerful training. Whatever happens when I'm sitting, I'm not going to be for it or against it or try to change it. I'm just going to hold it in the spacious awareness. Hold it in awareness. See if I can do that. Some people talk about coming to zero. Not for something or against something. And to have that ability, have a sense of what zero is like or what its non-reactive place is, gives a person a tremendous freedom for then acting in the world. But if you're reactive, if you don't have that zero point, if you have a tendency, if you don't even know it, that's possible, then you'll be, when you're ready to act in the world, chances are that your reactivity, the way that you're caught by the situation will influence what you end up doing. So coming to some degree of acceptance first, or coming to zero first, or having nothing at stake first, or finding some ability just to be receptive and hold it in an open mind, open heart first, then gives us a vantage point that can be wiser to decide how to change things and what needs to be done. And what needs to be done in a corporation, I have no idea. And how you can change other people, I don't know much about. But if you can change yourself first, then maybe you're less likely to get in trouble. or to do it for the wrong reasons, or get impatient. I mean, this is what I deal with, you know, every day, being a parent. You know, that very question, you know. I can't accept some of the things going on at home. No way. You know, I mean, I can't accept it in the sense of, you know, that it's fine, you know. Our living room would be just a shape for our living room. If I accept it, it's all fine, you know. But what I try to do is my mind tries to stay peaceful, spacious, open around what's happening in the living room. And then I'll go over there to the kids and say, "It's time to clean up. It's time to clean up. If you don't clean up right now, if you don't clean up now, we can't do the next thing. Or I think it's time for you to go to your room." I try to do it, you know, compassionately, kindly, without any anger or charge. And it's not always possible, but I try to do it. And so far, I'm amazed how effective it is. "I think it's time for you to go to your room. I'll tell you when you can come out." In that kind of voice. And so I'm waiting for it not to work. And then we'll have to figure out something else. But I mean, I struggle, but it's not easy. And so a lot of you probably have kids, and then sort of controlling kids. I mean, getting them ready for going to school in the morning, carpool and all that, is like herding cats. So how's the goal reflected in the means? Getting them off to the carpool. It must be easy in the corporations.
Thank you.
Last one, yeah.
Your kids aren't teenagers yet, but I do have a specific question about teenagers whose primary job is to separate from their parents by lying or by cheating or by... and they love to go to their rooms and just close the door. So, I wonder if you can expound on that a little bit with people who are dead set upon opposing you.
We'll see how that goes, what happens. But, I mean, I know at this age, for example, with my kids, that sometimes being non-reactive is the solution. Sometimes be caught in their orbit. It just makes things worse. So just not play the game that they're wanting you to play. You know, we see it with a two-year-old we have, that both of them, that if he wants to say no, "I'm not going to do it," right? The no thing, right? "I don't want to do that. I'm going to do it my way." And if I say you have to do it, or no, you can't do it, or whatever, you know, engage in with it, it can go on for hours, that engagement, you know, back and forth. And he's stubborn. He'll hang in there. But if I just walk away, you know, or just not play the game with him, then he forgets about it really quickly. So I don't know how that works with teenagers, but teenagers are complicated animals. I don't know, I can't understand them at this point. They're so far away from me. My oldest is 7. But I do have one story that is kind of an inspiration for me, maybe when my kids are teenagers, and that is, the model of how my parents parented me. And when I was 14, my friend and I was going to take my father's little car he had a little Fiat, teeny Fiat 500, I think, to 600, little teeny Fiat, and we got the keys, and promptly took the Fiat and ran into a bulldozer. And so I had to call my father up and say, you know, we ran into, you know, crashed into a bulldozer with your car. And he just said, oh, what kind of damage is it? Oh, we can't open the right-hand door. And he said, oh, does it still drive? Oh, yeah, it drives fine. Well, see what you can do about the door. I'll see you when I get home. That was it. And, you know, that's, maybe he knew how ashamed I was or how remorseful I was. And there was no more need to do anything else. And he just took, you know, very spacious, very open about it. And I never got any anger. There was no more discussion about it. I don't remember whether we got the door pried open or not. But, you know, it helped that it was a kind of old beat-up car. But, so I'm sure there are ways to not be caught in the orbit. And as soon as we get caught in the orbit, then it's dangerous. So maybe it's your job to figure out what orbit you're in and step out of the orbit when you try to respond lovingly and strictly. I mean, you're asking difficult questions today. I don't know how to answer any of your questions here. because you're asking about other people. But what Dharma practice does is really help you work on yourself. And if you can clarify and liberate yourself, then hopefully you have a better chance of making wise choices with the world around you.
Thank you.
So, thank you.